Dr. Degner is signaling to me here that we should get started because we've got a tight schedule. And,
It's okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Of course, you know I'm about to introduce Professor Wenthe, the good friend of mine. Came to our seminary in 1971 as a graduate of the St. Louis Seminary. He graduated from St. Louis during those very dark days. And somehow he came through unscathed. I mean, through St. Louis. He came to us as an assistant prof. And while he was at, during our last years there in Springfield, he studied at Princeton Seminary as time allowed. He got his Master of Theology there in 1975. I believe you studied under Metzger, didn't you? Bruce Metzger. Anyway, about the time the seminary moved here in 76, he decided to go into the parish ministry, which he had never done. He was in the parish ministry from 76 to 80, and many times while he was out there in the parish, I heard it said on the campus that we ought to call Wenthe back to this seminary, which of course was done. And his going out in the ministry did him a lot of good. I don't mean that he was very green before he went out, but it made a better man of him. He was a good man before he went out. I'm screwing this all up here. In 1985, he got his M.A. from the University of Notre Dame. He's still a good Lutheran. We've got a number of men going to Notre Dame. Anyway, in September of this year, he is to defend his dissertation on the textual traditions of Daniel 1-6. Is that correct? Yeah. You know, of course, or maybe you don't know, that about a year ago, the BHES tried to get Wenthe as the theological consultant on the Board for Higher Educational Services, and we're glad he turned that down because we need him on this campus. He, as you know, of course, is associate editor of the Concordia Self-Study Bible. He is a member of Synod's Literature Commission, author of various articles, and most of all, he is a good friend of faculty members and students. It is a pleasure to introduce Dean Wenthe, who will speak to you on what is this, 1QM, the War of the Sons of Light Against the Sons of Darkness. Dean Wenthe.
Thank you, Dr. Bowles. I have the great privilege of having my office next to Dr. Bowles, and I think in 10 years he hasn't led me astray once. He's definitely a son of the light, and it's really a pleasure, though when you go on a trip with him, we went to Greece and Turkey last year, you discover that he has a way with the Greek femininity that overshadows youth. They honor the hoary or white head over there. And so if you go on a trip with him, be prepared to give him all the honor because the locals will. When I received the invitation to speak on a brief topic for the exegetical forum, I thought, what would be appropriate? And having been in Israel when there were some hostilities, I have a certain interest in warfare. And I thought, well, the Missouri Synod certainly has an interest that might be cognate with the 1QM, the War Scroll. Now, I had an outline here if you have one available to you, and with that would like to begin to explore this very fascinating text. If you look at the little quote at the top of the outline, Professor Sukenik says, "This is a document of a unique character and without parallel so far, even in the unique literature of the Qumran sect." So with that, I'd like to provide some reflections on the War Scroll 1QM. Recent scholarship has rightly focused energy and attention on a key element in the life of ancient communities, namely, how their understanding and appropriation of sacred texts define their identity. The extensive study entitled Mikra and edited by Martin Jan Mulder, Fortress 1988, is but one example that could be cited. To a degree, perhaps only infrequently achieved in our day, ancient sages and their followers strove to embody and live out the text which they revered as communicative of God's will. For Christians, and therefore I trust for Lutherans, a particularly fascinating and rich environment for such research is that of Second Temple Judaism. In this epoch, though we might wish for more, we are still the beneficiaries of significant literary efforts. The Judaisms of a Philo, of a Josephus, of the Apocrypha, of the Pseudepigrapha, of the Rabbis, of the Targumim, and others, whatever their sometimes fundamental differences, have in common a profound reverence for a text which the Church also confesses to be God's Word, that is, the Old Testament. The question, of course, which cries out for attention is precisely how the same text, regarded as authoritative by all, could spawn such diverse understandings. To address this question, it becomes necessary not simply to describe what an ancient author or community regarded as God's Word, but also how that text was used to frame its distinctive claim. As one scholar puts it, how did one establish the hermeneutical rules which were created to legitimize one's own community? In this segment of time, I would like to invite your attention to the remarkable Second Temple text 1QM, the War Scroll from Qumran. Our brief look will focus on particularly this facet of the War Scroll. What role did the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, play in this document's description of that community's constituency and of its future? How did the Old Testament shape its self-understanding? Further, can we describe the how, the hermeneutic, if you will, of 1QM's appropriation of the Old Testament? If we can, we will have another window on how texts were used in the Palestinian environment, which was then the setting for the teacher from Nazareth who came to announce and to expound the kingdom of God. 1QM. This scroll, designated DSW in earlier studies, has stimulated much scholarly discussion. As Gezer Vermish says, within the corpus of post-Maccabean literature, it is a unique representative of an almost unparalleled genre. Not only an awareness of its distinctive nature, but also considerable debate concerning the document's date and history has marked recent research. Two dates have been offered and defended as the most probable, the Seleucid period and the Roman period. Within each of these two major options, a diversity of opinion on the precise date remains. The Seleucid period proposals include at the very beginning of the Maccabean Revolt, 165 to 164 BC, at the height of Jonathan's military power, 143, and during the reign of John Hyrcanus, 135 to 104. Other scholars suggest a Roman providence for the document, and most dated in the middle of the 1st century B.C. Yigael Yadin assigns the composition of the scroll to a date between the capture of Jerusalem by Pompey, 65 B.C., and the death of Herod, 4 A.D. F.M. Cross supports this and brings paleography and archaeological arguments to support a similar period. And most, I think, now would incline to that date. Form. The majority of scholars, particularly those who date 1 QM to the Roman period, regard the war scroll as a description of the eschatological war which will bring the end of the epoch in the eyes of the sectaries. That there are no precise parallels to the genre of 1 QM is generally acknowledged. This high level, however, of distinctiveness is set off by its content. It is the only work, Susan Nick says, in Hebrew, ancient or modern, dealing with the military art and containing a rich and original vocabulary of military terms, names of weapons and other instruments of war, of tactical moves and strategies, and of martial music. This detail has led others to question whether it can be called an apocalyptic. Some suggest that an imminent conflict is in view. According to this analysis, the community is actually planning for a battle. While acknowledging the force of such arguments, 1 QM cannot be fully appreciated when an overly literalistic reading is adopted. It is far more likely that the exact military descriptions serve the larger theological purpose than that a battle plan has been given a theological rationale. The symmetry of the work certainly suggests this. For example, Yadin says, "It is a theological writing, and the war of which it treats symbolizes the eternal struggle between the spirits of light and darkness. The phases of its battle are fixed in advance, its plan established, and its duration predetermined. The opposing forces are equally matched, and only by the intervention of the mighty hand of God is the balance between them to be disturbed when he deals an everlasting blow to Satan and all the hosts of the kingdom." Structure. The content of 1 QM is highly structured, and if you look at the handout, you can see it's tripartite. It has an introduction that's further broken down for you, a middle section that we'll talk about, and then a concluding portion. In each of these, I've tried to outline biblical texts that play a big role in 1 QM, and we'll try to analyze how their view of this eschatological battle was informed and shaped by these texts. First, the use of the Hebrew scriptures in 1 QM. The variety of ways in which the Old Testament appears in this text, along with the often difficult task of assessing when an allusion is intended, poses a methodological problem. Should one move from the more explicit to the less explicit citations and allusions, or should one proceed through the text from the opening section onward? It seems best for the moment to work through the text in its present or canonical order. The working assumption will be that even an eclectic and elusive use of the Hebrew Scriptures will display an interpretative attitude or hermeneutic. As Joseph Fitzmyer says, in Qumran literature, and we frequently find what might be called the anthological style, the working of Old Testament expressions and phrases into the very fabric of the composition. This also displays frequently an exegetical and interpretive posture. Section 1, then, the introduction. The initial statement of conflict between the sons of light against the sons of dark uses a number of phrases: the army of Belial, the troops of Edom and Moab, the sons of Ammon, the army of Philistia, the troops of Kittim and Ashur, the offenders against the covenant. The The portrayal of the community's enemies is acknowledged as an echo of various descriptions within the Hebrew Scriptures. Yadin asserts that its antecedents are 2 Kings 24:2, Isaiah 11:14, and Daniel 11:41 through 42. And I believe those are on your outline. A review of those texts indicates that some elements are common to all four: Moab, the sons of Edom, Edom. This list may also be supplemented by Psalm 83, 7 through 9. In this, the list is most extensive and it contains all the elements of one QM. It is also noteworthy that a similar grouping of opponents appears in the Book of Jubilees, where the sons of Esau are portrayed as conspiring against Jacob. I'll quote Jubilees. "Let us send to Aram and Philistia and Moab and Ammon, and let us choose for ourselves chosen men who are ardent for battle." Thus, 1QM opens with a stylized presentation of the community's opponents. It may be that Psalm 83, with the same names in the same order, is the best antecedent. On the other hand, the standardized nature of such a grouping, as evidenced by Jubilees, would invite a certain caution in positing a direct relationship between the two. It may also be that the organizing principle of this description is to move from the traditional and geographically close enemy, namely Edom, Moab, and Philistia, to the foreign enemy, whether Greek or Roman, and then to the traitors from within. Opposed to the army of Belial are the sons of Levi, the sons of Judah, the sons of Benjamin, and the exiles of the wilderness. These are the Missouri Synod good guys. The order of the names does not coincide with any biblical list. In Ezra 1:5 and 2 Chronicles 11, 11 and following, Judah and Benjamin are prior to the priests and Levites. The promise of the Levi may stem from the biblical emphasis on his role as a warrior. The tendency of the sons of Jacob to go to war three at a time appears also in the Book of Jubilees, though the groupings are different. There we have Judah, Naphtali, and Gad, Levi, Dan, and Asher, Reuben, Issachar, Zebulun, Simeon, Benjamin, and Enoch, Reuben's son. A key question in the overall structuring of the introduction is the nature of its relationship to Daniel 11. A number of linguistic affinities have been noted. These are the days of the wicked, is one phrase. He, in 11:44 of Daniel, "He will go forth with great fury," is also in the introduction. "None shall help him. The land will not escape." There are a whole group of phrases from Daniel 11 in the prologue to the war scroll. One way to explain these parallels is to suggest with Yadin that the author has simply drawn images from this text without seeking to link the context of the Daniel passage to the historical context of the community. On the other hand, it seems that the interpretation of column 1 could not neglect Daniel 11 in meaning 2, because both texts prophesied the same last days before the time of trouble such as never was, causing the salvation of Israel. While certainty on such a question is unattainable, this latter interpretation finds parallels in other Qumran texts. Brownlee has pointed out the way in which 1Q Pesher Habakkuk places the Kittim of Daniel 11:30 on the eschatological stage. The Midrash in Habakkuk 1:8 through 9 displays an eschatological application to the Kittim, a people concerning whom Numbers 24:24 and Daniel 11:30 predicted an eschatological role. Thus, the introductory section of 1QM uses the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, both to identify the community and to place them on the stage of the final eschatological battle. Its anthological style conveys in an eclectic manner images through which the community understood its future. And particularly its use of Daniel 11 seems to have organized the community's hope and conviction for that future. The next section describes column 1, lines 8 through 15, the violence of the final stage of the eschatological war. Again, there are a number of allusions to the Old Testament. I'll highlight simply two. While many of the allusions are general or even uncertain, Daniel 12:1, and I'll read it, and there will be a time of trouble such as never has been, this is a frequent motif, stresses the certainty of the victory for the sons of light. The application of this passage to the forthcoming eschatological triumph of the community is in keeping with the manner in which Daniel 11 is used throughout column 1 and following. The clear purpose of this section is to give courage to the sons of light. It closes the seventh and final episode of the battle by asserting that the hand of our great God will grant victory. Most would say that this expression is drawn directly from Exodus 14:31, where we have, "And Israel saw the powerful great hand which the Lord used against Egypt." The likelihood that a clear use of Exodus is intended is increased by the fact that the angels, not God himself, are operative until the seventh lot. Thus, God's direct intervention is portrayed as analogous to the grand deliverance of the Exodus. The next section, column 1, 16 through column 2, line 14. This section portrays the 40 years of war by treating certain aspects of its execution, sabbatical years and the divisions of the congregation for fighting purposes are discussed. A surprising departure from the biblical pattern of 24, 1 Chronicles 24 and 25, is that the priests are to serve in 26 courses as the war begins. This, along with other texts from Qumran, demonstrates that the sectaries differed with the rest of the Jewish community on the matter of calendar. The crucial difference that the calendar made for the whole pattern of ancient religions and its observance can scarcely be overemphasized. Yadin states, "This is an important fact, for it confirms that the sect completely accepted the calendar of Jubilees in Enoch, a fact which has been known for some time. This difference, among others, not only hindered the sect from participating in the bringing of sacrifices with other Jews, but was also an important factor in the continual clashes on matters concerning the observation and times of the festivals." If Daniel was the most influential corpus in the first two sections, the book of Numbers is a rich source of imagery for this section. You have all sorts of phrases like the heads of the families of the houses, the elect men of the assembly, or even the phrase from Moses in Numbers 31:3, "Arm men from among you for war." It's clear that the author views the ordering of the community for this great eschatological conflict in terms of that ordering which Numbers describes without officially or explicitly citing the text of Numbers. The allusions within this section are at least 20 in number. The tentative nature of them should not reduce their importance or their elusive nature. Daniel Patti has called this the weak anthological style. Contextually, it is probable that the cumulative force of such allusions would have led the member of the community to view its constituency as analogous to Israel, preparing for its end, even as Israel prepared for conquest of the land. from our perspective, this appears more like a rhetorical use of text to form the desired theological collage than an exposition of the text vis-a-vis its original setting. This freedom over against the Old Testament emerges in other ways in 1QM. For example, the nations of Genesis 10 are enumerated in a completely different order and time in which each of the opposing nations are to meet. The fact that Genesis 10 is in view is widely acknowledged due to the almost complete similarity in the listing of the nations. Yet it is probable that the geographical pattern of the Hebrew Scriptures from southeast to northwest was reversed in 1QM to serve the author's military agenda. Another significant feature of this section is the length of the envisioned conflict, namely 40 years. The frequent reference to numbers in conjunction with the organization of the congregation makes it highly likely that the author portrays the forthcoming conflict as foreshadowed in the 40 years of wilderness wandering by the Israelites. One scholar puts it like this: the community, the exiles of the desert, would, after a preliminary attack on the army of Satan, symbolized by the ungodly of the covenant and their foreign allies from the environs of Judea, followed by an assault on the Kittim, then occupy the Holy Land and move to Jerusalem. Now that concludes the long introductory section. The middle section, which is really the heart of 1QM, is called by Yadin the Seric section, and you have that on the outline as well. It is ordered in two sections, the Battle Seric, or Order Series, Stipulations, and then the Ritual Order Series. What is interesting here, broadly speaking, is that Section 1 continues this elusive ad hoc quoting of the Old Testament, whereas in the second section, the Ritual Ordering Series, you have explicit citations of the text that I listed there. If you look at the Battle Seric Series, it's fascinating. This section opens with a description of the deployment of the community. Its organization occurs in conjunction with the proper appointment of trumpets, banners, and the full complement of military paraphernalia. 3:1-11 is particularly devoted to the role of trumpets. Each trumpet is assigned a particular function and inscription. There can be little doubt that Numbers 10:1-10 serves as a paradigm for the present description. The trumpets to call the community together, the trumpets for calling the commanders, the trumpets of the camp, the trumpets of the slain, reflect the pristine organization of Israel, though there is no slavish repetition of text. For example, the trumpets of the men of renown in 1QM 3:3 are absent from Numbers, and the order is accommodated in all likelihood to their tactical models. After the trumpets, the lengthy stipulations concerning the banners are introduced. The whole section uses Numbers 2, verse 2, as a departure point. Here alone in the book of Numbers, the banners are coordinated with the organization of the congregation. The inscriptions on the banners are no doubt a development of Numbers 17:17-18, where the rods, the mate, are to be inscribed with each man's name. Scholars point out that the congregation's deployment revolves around two groups, the family of Levi, ordered for war, and the rest of the congregation, namely the militia. These two basic configurations are anticipated in the host of the service and the host of the battle. This division is evidenced by the fact that the banners of the congregation and of the tribe of Levi are treated separately. The fact that the banner of the congregation positioned for battle is to have the inscription Assembly of God, Adat El, may allude to the idea also present in Numbers of the Adat Yahweh. Even if these texts are not in the author's mind as he wrote, it seems certain that the community is being defined vis-a-vis the portrayal in Numbers. The author's description of the community is, from his perspective, continuous with true Israel. And he suggests this by the manner in which the banners of the congregation are inscribed with the names of Israel and Aaron, as well as the names of the 12 tribes of Israel according to their order of birth. This seems to recast the story of the engraving of the names of the son of Israel in the order of their birth on the onyx stones of Exodus 28:9 through 10. Further, the reference to the camps of the three tribes and the prince of the tribes draws directly on Numbers 2, where just such a structure of four camps is in view. Numbers 2, 3, etc. uses the same word for leader or prince as is used in 1QM. The text divides the family of Levi into Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Gershon and Kohath are agreed to have a place at the mutilated end of column 3, along with Numbers 3:17. There are extensive word plays on the numbers that are laid out in 1QM. The intertwining of such literary devices with biblical texts is another indicator of the creativity of the author and the freedom which he enjoyed in adopting biblical images to his theological purpose. The description of the shields in the front formation also echoes biblical imagery. In fact, I found this fascinating. The size of the shield is very close to the Ark of the Testimony in Exodus 25. A cubit and a half occurs in the measurements of the table, the boards of the tabernacle, and the molten sea of brass, and also is the size of the shields. After the stipulations concerning spears and swords, there follows a survey of regrouping for battle. This section ends then with some ritual activity by the tribe of Levi, and also has a fascinating reference to a Roman tower as a part of the battle formation, not unlike what our students saw at Qumran this year in their travels there. The ritual series, let me move on to that, which holds up for you the five passages. These are quoted, as we're down here at this point right now, in detail, and they are cited very much lay more, it is written or it is said, Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 20, Numbers 10, Numbers 24, and Isaiah 31. Let me quickly review those and then conclude. As one goes through these texts from Deuteronomy, and you can see their prominence, it's clear that the authors have drawn upon the encouragement that Moses was offering the children of Israel prior to their conquest of the land to the people of Qumran. If you look, for example, at Deuteronomy 20, 2 through 5, and it shall be when you draw near unto the battle that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, you draw nigh this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint, fear not, nor be alarmed, neither be afraid at them. And I'll omit some of the detail to kind of move toward a conclusion. What I think you have already sensed is here is a community that reveres the Old Testament, and they define themselves and their history in its categories. So much so that they see themselves as one with the people of God in numbers prior to the conquest of the land and what have you. Now, given all that, it is interesting to ask, How could they then come out at such a different point than other communities, and at a later point also the Christian community, with regard to what those texts actually meant? Michael Fishbane, in a recent essay, I thought led the way in explaining this when he said, "Thus, just as the true application of the laws is the result of the interpretive techniques and meanings revealed to the interpreter of Torah and his followers, so also the true application of the prophecies is the product of techniques and meanings revealed to the teacher of righteousness and his followers." What that, I think, suggests is that it all reaches back to whoever controls the redemptive media, to quote Joseph Blenkinsop. The teacher of righteousness influencing the construal of Old Testament texts produces, or one of his students, 1QM, or the community there, one can't nail this down, a very different portrait of the end times than does the teacher from Nazareth. Now, where I think this has a great deal of potential interest for us is that as Jesus announced the kingdom and expounded it, the environment of Galilee would have had this as well as other interpretive schemes in it, so that our Lord not only had to declare the Old Testament, but he had to expound it, had to provide a hermeneutical vision contrary to and distinct from the many other possibilities. And if one takes the Gospels at face value and believes, as Luke 24 suggests, that our Lord engaged in some scriptural seminars with the disciples, opened their eyes to the Scriptures, then the distinctiveness of the New Testament hermeneutic, just as the distinctiveness of the Qumran community, isn't in how they regard the Old Testament formally as authority, but it's in which teacher they believe, and that teacher is the expounder of Torah, of prophecy, and the claim that we would hold up is that the teacher from Nazareth was indeed the Messiah who taught not as the scribes and Pharisees. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Wenthe. Are there any questions? I guess you understood everything that he said, huh? Professor Veltz?
Dean, thanks very much. On this last part with the hermeneutical implications, do you see that it's really a question of techniques of interpretation as hermeneutics? Let's just contrast Jesus and the teacher of righteousness. Or is it really a matter of a difference of referent, simply? In other words, to whom these things, which community, which people, these things are being applied. So is it a referential difference, or is it actually a difference in interpretive technique?
I think it's a difference in referential, but isn't there also with that a sort of baggage that brings different technique? I think one could argue some continuity in technique. There's, I think, a more discrete discontinuity in terms of the referent.
I'm just wondering, with the first part, not the ritual series, But under the rule of war here, the battle series, when you were talking about these allusions and this ontological style, what hermeneutical function that kind of thing actually plays? I think that's an interesting question. Is that style used simply to declare that we are the successors to the people of God in the Old Testament? Or is it something else? Now, if it's that, then there might be, in fact, a different hermeneutical technique, because what the New Testament is doing is saying that we have foretaste of the eschatological fulfillment in the Old Testament, not simply that we are the successors. So it kind of reverses the scheme.
Okay, good. I think the it's both and, isn't it, that you have a clear aim, I think, to be identified with that group. But once that identity is made, you know, who are the sons of Abraham? Well, we are, from the vantage point of Paul. They would take a little different tact, and both, however, in terms of technique, want that text to define their past, present, and future.
Man over here.
Just a question on a point of information. I believe the essayist said that the death of Herod took place in 4 AD. Is that right?
I think I quoted Yadin. No, I. Let's see, what did I say there? Gail Yadin assigns the composition of the scroll to date between the capture of Jerusalem by Pompey 65 and the death of Herod 4 AD.
4 AD?
BC.
Check on that one.
Right, BC. Good, thank you.
Pastor Sherb?
My question is to follow up on, I think, the very perceptive one of Professor Veltz. If you are talking about a difference in hermeneutical technique, and I don't want you to do a whole new paper for us now, but speculate, if you would, how, from the standpoint of readers 2,000 years later, we can really get an idea of what those techniques were by contrast to the New Testaments.
Well, in a word, I think the rich kind of variety. Let's say if you contrast a Philo with a Josephus with some of the things that are done in the Apocrypha, in the Pseudepigrapha, with what's done at Qumran, at each place, I don't think you can be real dogmatic as though they had a well-defined hermeneutic, even as the rabbis had their hermeneutical debates. I think what emerges, if you look through late antique, is that all of them participated in kind of the Greco-Roman world discussion in ways that maybe we weren't sensitive enough to before. That is, they were aware, the Jews in Palestine, as Dr. Belt said, Alexander the Great was a great evangelist for the Hellenization of the world. So I think they were more conversant and had a number of things in common, the sort of ways vocabulary could be used and recognized. So I think the challenge is to state what the scriptural hermeneutic has in common with rabbinic works, and Jesus uses arguments from the rabbis and others, and then also contrast what's distinctive to the New Testament.
I guess that concludes this part of the program. Reverend Roberts has some announcements to make.
Just a couple of messages that we got. Reverend Eric Lang is asked to call his wife as soon as possible, and Paul Grimm is to call his secretary as soon as possible. One of them said the rabbit died, but I don't know which one right now. I'm sorry about that. We'll explain it to you Norwegians later.